drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to the drawing room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. Do you think much about the way you eat, why you eat, and how what you eat impacts not only who you are, but how you're connected to nature and to other people? Well, these are some of the things that artist Elizabeth Willing would like us to reflect a little deeper on. Food is front and centre of Elizabeth's work, sometimes being both the subject and the material. And through installations, sculptures and performance, she hopes to get us to think more about our relationship with food. Her new body of work, Forced Rhubarb, features hand-printed and embroidered linens, but also a large looping floor work made from brightly coloured sherbet-filled straws. Elizabeth is my guest here in the drawing room tonight. Welcome to you, Elizabeth. Come on in. Take a seat.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Were you a picky eater as a child?
No, but early in, I guess, my 20s, I did become a vegetarian. So you could say that's a version of being picky.
a latent version of being a picky eater as a child. And so how did that sort of realization about yourself come about and therefore influence your work?
I mean, I think that there was definitely some complicated relationships to food in my family, which influenced my understanding of food growing up. And then, as I already mentioned, I kind of had an ethical standpoint on food as well. We had some allergies in our family as well. So we thought about food, but not in a romantic way. We kind of didn't have a lot of rituals or traditions around food. We just sort of thought about it and had to like problem solve it a lot. So I do think that that sort of laid a bit of a foundation for my my work with food. But when it came to using food in my art practice, I guess I just moved out of home. I was learning how to cook, and that was really fun, really interesting. And I enjoyed it as a process and as a way to relieve stress. So that was kind of where my working with food, my interest in food started.
Tell me about Forced Rhubarb. Tell me about the name first and foremost.
Yeah, I found it in a textbook about yeasts. It was listing the different environments of a particular yeast, and one of the environments that they had studied this yeast in was Forced Rhubarb. They'd found this yeast, you know, on Forced Rhubarb. And when I looked into Forced Rhubarb, I was fascinated with the technique of creating it. So that's really forced. It's really unnatural. It's sort of like the white asparagus thing where they cover it up so that there's no light, and then they put it in this big shed and it's buried, and then there's just candles. And the rhubarb is kind of trying to find this light, but it just kind of stays in the darkness. And so it's very pale and quite, it's softer than regular rhubarb. Rhubarb's quite acidic. So I guess I kind of love the idea of Forced Rhubarb because it was so man-made in a way, like it's a vegetable or a fruit or whatever it is, but there was so much human intervention into it. And I love that idea because it was kind of like a machine had produced it, but it was this natural product.
Because we've almost forgotten about the seasonality of food with those global supply chains. We get, you know, mandarins out of season from different parts of the world and vegetables that we wouldn't ordinarily expect in the wrong season. Is that the point you're trying to make about how, I suppose, captured this type of food or vegetable has become to the wishes of humankind?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that we can get certain fruits or vegetables cheaper if we fly them in from the other side of the world is outrageous, but it's part of this system that also makes sense in the logic of, you know, the global economy. And I mean, I like to kind of, you know, discover more about those sort of systems, and I like to let those ideas permeate the work without trying to make direct comment on them. I mean, it's such a complicated web or network or rhizome that we're sort of working in, and I have positions on it, but I don't want the work to be talking directly about those issues. I want them to be ingredients in the work, without having to kind of take a direct stance.
Questions, not answers. I certainly get it.
Yes.
Let's talk about yeast. Now, yeast is a fascinating thing. I became a little bit familiar with it learning to brew beer about 5 years ago. And this is a magical substance. What drew you to be interested in yeast?
It's been a sort of slow love affair that's developed. I've definitely read a lot about yeast over the years just through my food research and kind of started to get this sense that it was like this collaboration between humans and this like cells in making bread and, as you say, beer and wine. But my interest really, I mean, I really fed my interest, you could say, through a residency with the Australian Wine Research Institute in Adelaide, which was supported by Australian Network of Technology. And I spent 3 months on site there researching wine and developed a creative project around wine. And one of the things that really surprised me was, yeah, how interesting yeast was. And I spent days just in the library flicking through these textbooks of yeast. And I was really drawn to how, well, just that they're everywhere. They're like this weird sort of matter that kind of crosses all living, non-living objects, but also lives in the deepest parts of the ocean and in the atmosphere. I guess I didn't realize that, but I was also fascinated with how much of an impact they have on wine flavor as well. It was an explosion of ideas and interest, really, working and researching yeasts.
It really is a very transformative sort of ingredient in wine and beer. I remember learning that really it's not just the grain bill or the type of hops that goes into beer, but yeast has the biggest effect, if you like, on the flavour of beer, something that I never would have thought as an amateur enjoyer of the odd beer.
Yeah, absolutely. And this kind of push-pull between whether, you know, you want to use natural yeasts that just occur naturally in the environment or in that mix, or whether you want to kind of introduce these commercially produced ones as well. So, I've definitely kept a close eye on that now that I know that. It's kind of something fascinating to look into when you're buying a beer or wine as well.
The texture of what we consume or eat is hugely important to our experience of eating it. I mean, for example, the slippery and salty texture of oysters. I mean, while some of us are repulsed by that, certainly some listening to this might be indeed, but how important is texture to your work using food?
Because we're not allowed to touch art, it's much more about the sort of visuals instead of the tactile. I think food has really fascinating textures, and one of the benefits of using food as a material is that people are really familiar with the texture and the flavor of food. So when you use those materials, you're kind of using the inbuilt knowledge of viewers to kind of fill in a lot of the gaps for the work. And then you've got smell, which can kind of be present in the gallery, and the gallery is so void of smell that it's easy to sort of fill that space. So I think that texture is a really fun one to play with. I think that it lends itself really well to sculpture, which I play with a lot. Yeah, I mean, I guess the gallery is just so untextured, so it's easy to kind of play with that material and have it really stand out.
You often use highly processed, visually enticing foods in your work. One example in your current exhibition are the tubes of sherbet used in the work Movie Prep. For anyone who's been into hospital before a procedure, they'd be familiar with Movie Prep, I believe. But how do you describe this work and how it came about?
Yeah, I think I saw a young person eating one of those tubes of sugar. Those tubes of sherbet after the Ekka, which is like the Brisbane version of the show or whatever, and you get these show bags full of horrendous candy. And this child snipped the end off and just sort of emptied it into their mouth. And I was so engrossed in that gesture of just kind of pouring sugar into the body.
Like a mouthful of sand, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I was really grossed out, but also completely seduced by this idea of just like mainlining sugar and the colors of it as well, you know. And I saw this tube as sort of an extension of the throat or the esophagus and the guts and the intestines. And so I kind of wanted to play around with that idea. So the work Comovia Prep is one huge floor installation made up of like many, many individual straws all joined end to end, making big, huge loops. And because the sherbet is sort of rainbow colored, it kind of just revolves through the colors. It's very, very bright. In the process of cutting the ends off the sherbet to join them to cutting the ends off the tubes to join them together, the sherbet spills out. I kind of can't stop it, but that's become the main feature of the work. Essentially, the way that the sherbet spills out of the tubes, it scatters on the ground and it makes these trails, and it becomes the traces of making the work. So you've got these traces, you've got this like a very expressive platform on the floor, and then you've got the tubes kind of sitting on top of it. So it's the sculpture and it's the traces of making the sculpture, and it's, I guess, sort of big intestine, but it could also be like a hose or I mean, it's quite an abstract form, so it could be read in many ways, but it has a nice smell too, a nice zingy sort of smell in the space.
A sherbety waft across the gallery there. On ABCRN, yeah. I'm Andy Park. Elizabeth Willing is my guest in the drawing room. We're talking about her new body of work called Forced Rhubarb and Playing with Food. I mean, I love nothing more than wandering around local farmers' markets on the weekend, Elizabeth, and speaking with the producers and finding out how, you know, why they do it and how they've come to produce what they produce. Do you think we've become more interested in food, the provenance of food, where it comes from, and how it's made along the process, like we've never become before, you know?
Yeah, I do. I think that maybe some of that stems from the fact that it's becoming more mysterious where our food comes from. Even though there seems to be a lot of information out there, it's all very contradictory, and we have such little relationship with farms and farmers. And then a lot of that food is kind of snatched up and processed through factories and turned into something that doesn't recognize, is almost unrecognizable as food anyway. So I think that we're kind of greedy for that kind of information at the moment. We're so starved for confirmation that our food is safe. So I think that the farmers market, especially for people living in the city, is kind of important to help us feel healthy and secure.
Yeah, and certainly connected to the chain of events that led for that wheel of cheese to end up in our shopping basket. Yeah. With installation artists like yourself, you actually get the opportunity to stand and watch other people interact with your work in the way that some other, you know, performance artists, for example, can't. Does that surprise you how people engage with your work? Do you take that opportunity to watch people engage with your work often?
Yeah, I love it. Actually, I love having to, or being able to sort of step back from the work and not having to perform it. I mean, there's a certain joy in being the activator of a work, but it's even more exciting to be able to create a work which activates itself and kind of enacts its own hospitality, you could say. And then being able to have all the ideas that you thought, all the ways that you thought people were going to engage with the work just totally thrown out the window. And this whole other set of systems and logics and performances kind of happen. So no matter how much I kind of imagine how the work will play out in the world, in the gallery, there's always different pathways that it will take and people's different approach to creation and engagement. And again, being a guest in the gallery, everyone has different ideas about that. So yeah, I love watching works develop and be co-created by the audience, and I learn a lot about how I'm going to make the next work from that process.
Yeah, it's a bit like misheard lyrics for songwriters. Sometimes the interpretation through someone else's ears are is interesting, if not more so. The theatre of restaurants is also something that interests you a lot. When you think about it, it's a pretty surreal environment with tablecloths and this kind of servitude going on, and out the back there's chefs slaving away just for your gratitude, if you like. You experience that in the way that others probably don't, and you keep your eyes open to some of these dynamics when you eat at, you know, a top-end restaurant. Is that part of your research?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I will take every opportunity that I can to do research like that. It's a privilege, really, to be able to go and be entertained and fed by these incredibly creative chefs. It, honestly, some of the most important experiences of my life have been in restaurants. And I love the really high-end restaurants. I love how much time and effort and thought and ethics have gone into what they've done. But I also really love the really low end of food. I like to engage in both and kind of take from both types of making, both types of studios, you could say. I think that there's a really high element of entertainment in high-end dining. In some sense, you know, the idea of going there to like gain nourishment is like absurd. I think that we're going there to like be entertained and to learn. You know, it's much more than just being sort of fed now. But a lot of my research has been around, you know, the way that different colors and shapes and lighting and materials influence our perception of flavor and quality and things. So now when I visit a restaurant, it's almost like trying to unpack everything that's there as well, which is really exciting. How does the sort of tablecloth and the shape of the table and the plateware, the materials they've used, how does the service influence the diner? And in that sense, it becomes like an installation in a gallery. There's been so much thought gone into it. And I guess that's the way that I appreciate those kind of spaces now.
Elizabeth, it's been fantastic to talk to you tonight here in the Drawing Room. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Andy. My pleasure.
Elizabeth Willing has been my guest in the Drawing Room. And you can savour the culinary delights of Forced Rhubarb at Tolano Galleries in Melbourne until Saturday. You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.